A warning to Syria, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. The White House says Syria may be preparing a new chemical attack, and it warns that Syria's government and its allies will pay a heavy price if it does. But the warning has taken many people by surprise.
Our military and intelligence contacts say they have no idea what the White House is talking about. This is a rather dangerous and unprecedented situation, and it's how big wars start, actually.
Plus, a French woman supports the anti-immigrant National Front until
she crosses paths with an Iranian refugee in his 30s, a man called Mukhtar, and falls madly in love with him.
Find out how the love story ends ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The tinderbox that is Syria may have gotten even more dangerous today. We learned this morning that the White House believes the Syrian government may be preparing another chemical weapons attack against its own people, and that the U.S. has put Syria on notice that it will pay a heavy price if it does. Back in April, the Trump administration bombed a Syrian airbase after a previous chemical attack. This time, the administration is also clearly warning Syria's allies, Iran and Russia, that they would also be held responsible. And that raises the stakes. Borzu Daragahi is world correspondent for BuzzFeed News. Borzu, this means one thing, the threat of serious U.S. military retaliation if Syria uses poison gas again. Is that right?
On the surface, that's what it means. We're still not clear as to where the information is coming from. Our military and intelligence contacts say they have no idea what the White House is talking about. And so that makes it a little bit confusing in terms of where they're getting this information, whether this is something that has been present, this possible use of chemical weapons has been present for some time, and the White House is bringing it up now in this particular way to divert attention from other issues, or whether it has some kind of fresh intel that no one else is privy to, including people at the Pentagon and other security organizations in the U.S.
Yeah, because there are conflicting reports in Washington, some saying that the Defense Department and State Department knew nothing of this threat. I mean, that raises an issue of credibility. How credibly is this warning being taken in the region?
I think it's being taken credibly. You know, I mean, this is a land of conspiracy theories about false flag operations and, machinations that are unknown to the average person and so on. So, I mean, it's not at the top thing of people's attention right now. But, for those who are watching, I'm sure many of them just consider this another attempt by the U.S. to justify military action in yet another Arab land.
There does seem to be a ratcheting up of U.S. involvement in Syria and a willingness to take on Iran, if only in rhetoric. What else has been going on here?
Well, it's not just rhetoric. I mean, I think you've had numerous instances where the U.S. on the one hand and its allies and the Syrian regime and its allies, including Russia and Iran and affiliated militias, have crossed each other in the battlefield, and it has led to casualties and so on. This is a rather dangerous and unprecedented situation, and it's how big wars start, actually. Over the last couple centuries or so, the big wars have happened because of miscalculations and accidents between the great powers sort of stumbling into wars. And this is the kind of situation that we're getting into now with all these big powers crowded around in various corners of Syria, each trying to anticipate what the other side is going to do, each rather confident of its moral and strategic position, each poising itself for where it will take land or take opportunities or take resources once ISIS falls. And it's a really dangerous situation. And I don't see anyone in the Trump administration, in Tehran, in Moscow, or even in Ankara speaking intelligently and wisely about it.
There's also a lot of talk from the U.S. administration about Iran and the need to contain it. Both National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster and Secretary of Defense James Mattis have written about the need to contain Iran, to contain the spread of Iranian power in the Middle East. Do you see the potential for a military conflict there?
I mean, there's a potential, but, you know, like I said, if it happens, it'll happen on accident. I don't think anyone wants a big war. I don't think the Pentagon wants a big war. They want to contain Iran. They want to contain Iran's ambitions. I don't think Iran wants a big war with the U.S. They want to, in their own words, stop the spread of U.S. influence in the Gulf region and the Middle East. And they see that as a sort of strategic threat. They saw Iraq is a strategic threat, but they also see it as an opportunity to fulfill a destiny that they feel is, you know, their birthright to some extent. And so there's a real conflict of ideological goals and strategic considerations. Yes, there's a possibility that we could stumble into a big, ugly war that we didn't plan. And those are always the worst.
Borzu Dargahi is BuzzFeed's correspondent in Istanbul. Meanwhile, next door in Iraq, government officials say they're close to taking back the city of Mosul from ISIS. It would be a big blow to the organization, but okay, then what? Richard Hall is the world's man in Beirut. He says ISIS has suffered a lot of setbacks recently, but there's still a threat.
It's kind of staggering when you stand back and take a look at how much it's lost. At the height of its power, ISIS controlled around 30,000 square miles, and it had 11 million people under its control. It's lost about 60% of that. But it's not just territory. They've also lost prestige. They've lost a sense of invincibility that they once had. They've also lost income. They've lost manpower through losing this land. They really have a significant setback since then.
Are these losses hurting ISIS recruiting efforts?
They are. I mean, losing territory has a physical impact on people being able to get to ISIS territory. So they lost all this land on the borders of these countries, so it's hard for people to get there. It also has a remarkable effect on recruitment when they see that ISIS is losing. So people that might have been attracted to go and join the Islamic State in 2014 when it was victorious, this army sweeping through across the Middle East. Now it's losing territory. Their fighters are being killed every day by the coalition airstrikes. It's certainly having an effect.
Remind us where their land at its height stretched to and where it is now.
It's in the process of losing the city of Mosul. There are just a few more blocks there really to lose. But there's still a significant amount of territory in Iraq. So Hawija, for example, further south, and Tal Afar, still two large cities under ISIS control. Then in Syria, we still have large parts of the city of Raqqa. And then further south, in Deir ez-Zor, that's where the last big battle will probably take place. And then we have to look further afield even. We're looking now at Afghanistan as well.
If ISIS still has territory in Iraq, what makes Mosul so important?
Well, it was such a huge propaganda victory for ISIS to capture Mosul. This was the largest city under their control, more than 1 million people. So it's a huge symbolic loss to ISIS for them to be kicked out of Mosul. And also, like I say, there are strategic losses for them as well. There's the loss of revenue that they can gather from Mosul. They stormed into the banks, they looted the vaults, and they're able to extract taxes from the 1 million people that were in Mosul. There were oil fields nearby that they could take advantage of. So they're losing a ton of revenue, a ton of manpower, and the territory and the prestige that goes with holding the largest city.
As it loses territory, is ISIS more likely to focus on attacks abroad, whether they're sponsored or just inspired by ISIS?
We're already seeing a sharp uptick in attacks by ISIS. We've seen them carry out attacks in the UK and even recently in Iran. And this is a direct effect of them losing territory. As they're unable to fight on the ground, they'll increasingly look to strike out their enemies abroad with lone wolf attacks, people being inspired by ISIS and carrying out attacks on their own.
How do all these changes and all this kind of gradual retraction of ISIS, how does it affect U.S. policy in the region?
Well, that's interesting because all these different forces that aren't necessarily aligned were gathered together to fight ISIS. We're fast approaching the time when those guys start looking to what happens next. We're already seeing the beginnings of that. So if we look to Iraqi Kurdistan, for example, they're looking to a referendum to gain independence from Iraq. And then we look at the relationship between the US and Turkey. Now, they've been fighting ISIS together, and Turkey has been angry at the US for supporting the Kurds. It looks like the US is going to continue to do that. But we're already seeing fissures between the U.S. and Turkey. They're looking forward to what happens next. And then even in southeast Syria, there have been rising tensions between the U.S. and Iran-backed militias there. Iran is trying to keep a corridor between Tehran and Damascus, and the U.S. is trying to block that. And we're seeing increasing tensions on all these fronts as people look to what happens after ISIS.
Has U.S. strategy to fight ISIS changed over the past few years?
I don't think it has, actually. The strategy has remained largely the same, which is to fight ISIS militarily and support local groups on the ground with airstrikes. Trump promised a great acceleration of the fight against ISIS, but it's pretty much continued as it was under Obama.
Do you think it needs to change?
Well, the big change probably needs to come in the leadership that America needs to show over the next couple of years as all these different forces lose this common enemy that they had. And that's going to require diplomatic muscle on the part of the U.S., not just airstrikes.
That's the world's Richard Hall in Beirut. So what does the battle for Mosul look like from the ISIS side of the front lines? Our BBC colleague Quentin Somerville has spent months reporting in the region, and he's collected documents and photographs detailing how young ISIS fighters, some of them only teenagers, have fought and died for the Islamic State. Quentin begins his story just outside Mosul in a former ISIS hideout.
In those sleeping quarters, they were careless. Littered among bomb-making equipment and their clothes, they left a trail. There were notebooks, post-it notes, and IS internal documents. In breach of Islamic State orders, one of the dead fighters kept on him a mobile phone card. On it were prayers and battle songs for martyrs. But it also reveals private moments, photos of the men. Some of them appear just as boys. They're sleeping, they're playing, relaxing. In one of the fighters is washing his car. But soon the pictures give away to battle poses. These were pictures that were being prepared for martyrdom videos. I also found this handwritten notebook here in the corner. Is the owner's name in English, Abu Ali al-Muslawi. And right beside it, right under here, is his IS staff number. These are the notes from Abu Ali's lessons in firing mortars, the targeting, the theory and the mathematics involved. He's practiced right here with a real compass using coordinates from Google Maps. In the munitions section, though, this is important, in his own handwriting, he lists chemical munitions as a weapon. There's been much debate over whether IS has used chemical weapons in Mosul, but here at least in writing we know that they prepared to deploy those weapons. I met Ibrahim at an Iraqi security forces base near the front lines. Ibrahim was an IS fighter, but he was also a double agent. I showed him the photos that we'd found on the mobile phone card. We've changed his voice to hide his identity.
Is there anything you could tell us about any of these guys? Who's this?
I know them very well. Those are fighters. They were with the Khalid ibn al-Walid unit. This one was the section's commander. They acted as a support unit for the frontline troops. They would spring into action as soon as they are needed.
Most of the men were from Mosul, he said, but there were foreigners too.
Most of the foreign fighters are either snipers or suicide bombers. They are very fierce fighters. They think it's a game to play and have fun, not a war with battles, weirdness, and airstrikes. They have a mission to carry out. Once done, they don't care if they live or die.
The thing that really jumps out at you when you look at these private Islamic State photo albums is just how young many of the faces are in the pictures. And intelligence officers here at Mosul say that this has been a striking aspect of the Islamic State's defence of this city. That not only have they used foreign fighters, and not only did they convert locals, but they created a brand new army of child fighters who are willing to sacrifice their lives for the caliphate.
The BBC's Quentin Somerville reporting from just outside Mosul. Just ahead, the unlikely romance between a French far-right nationalist and an immigrant. You're with the world. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Let's dig in now on the Supreme Court's decision yesterday on President Trump's travel ban. The court decided to hear arguments on the constitutionality of the ban in the fall. But in the meantime, the justices allowed the ban to go into effect for some foreign nationals from the six affected countries. It said the U.S. can keep out only those who lack any, quote, bona fide relationship to a person or entity in the United States. That language is already the subject of intense debate. One of the groups that fought the presidential order is the International Refugee Assistance Project. Becca Heller is its director. She isn't happy with the court's decision, but she says in practical terms, it probably won't keep that many people out of the U.S.
I think that the practical impact is quite narrow. I think that it doesn't apply to the majority of refugees who stand to be admitted in the next 120 days, which is how long the freeze can last. I think that it doesn't apply to the vast majority of visa holders. It only possibly applies to people coming in on a tourist visa who know no one in the U.S. But I think that the stigmatic injury is enormous. I think that it continues this violation of the Constitution, of the Establishment Clause, saying if you're from a Muslim majority country, we feel free to discriminate against you coming into the U.S.
Who gets to decide what a bona fide relationship is?
That's a pretty excellent question. And I think we're waiting to see what the answer is. Obviously, we are doing a lot of legal research and have our own opinions about what constitutes a bona fide relationship. The Supreme Court didn't specify in their opinion what a bona fide relationship is. So we're hoping the government implements this in a way that's consistent with the plain text of the decision as well as with established law. But what the government is actually going to do remains to be seen. And if we have to, we'll go back to the district court to dispute their interpretation.
And will we simply see how this plays out at various checkpoints and borders crossing into the U.S.?
I'm hopeful that the government will issue guidelines before that happens. I think a lot of the chaos around the first travel ban was because the government just totally failed to promulgate any sort of guidance to border protection officers or other government officials at ports of entry. And I think that resulted in a lot of confusion. So the hope is that this time around, at the very least, the government is more organized than last time and is clear with sort of frontline staff about who's able to come in and under what circumstances.
Have you heard from any of your clients since yesterday's decision?
Yes, they are terrified.
What are they saying?
I mean, I think people don't understand what the decision means. It's being reported in a ton of different ways. Clients are just hearing that the U.S. isn't taking refugees anymore, which of course is not true, but it's sending a really bad signal. And I think it's also signaling to Muslims that we continue to not want to let them into this country. Even under the Supreme Court's ruling, viewed in the narrowest possible way, the Supreme Court is still allowing the government to say, if you're from one of these six majority Muslim countries, we don't want you to be able to come in. I think that the emotional injury that has wrought is still present, no matter how narrowly it's interpreted, and our clients feel that.
Becca Heller is the director of the International Refugee Assistance Project. Thanks, Becca.
Sure thing.
You've probably noticed immigration has been a big concern in other countries recently, too. One of them is France. And our next story is about someone who took a big turn on the issue and her life ended up going someplace she never expected. Not long ago, Béatrice Auré was an active member of the National Front. That's France's far-right anti-immigration party. Then one day, Auré offered a ride to a Sudanese migrant. That led to complications and eventually a charge of people smuggling. And today, 2 years later, a French court has just handed down a verdict. Paris-based reporter Vivian Walt has been following Auré's story almost from the beginning.
In a bitter, cold winter's evening, she picks up the Sudanese teenager hitchhiking along the side of the road, takes pity on him, drives him back to what's called the jungle, the refugee camp in Calais, and then gets completely intrigued by the most appalling conditions that refugees are living in at the height of the refugee crisis. There were 10,000 people living there, mostly in just tents and sleeping rough on the ground and really just barely surviving. And she was so horrified that she began volunteering, collecting clothes and food and roping in all her friends. And then, lo and behold, one day, a few months later, she crosses paths with an Iranian refugee in his 30s, a man called Mokhtar, and falls madly in love with him.
And what about him? What's his backstory?
Well, he was a refugee from Iran. He was a teacher of Persian who had fled his country. So when she met him, he and a few others had actually stitched up their lips as a kind of protest move against the conditions in the refugee camp. And if you can imagine, this is the state in which she met the man that she says she fell head over heels in love with. They couldn't really speak each other's languages. They used Google Translate to have conversations with each other.
And then Beatrice starts volunteering in the shantytown, bringing food and clothing and spending more time with Mokhtar. And then he and his friends actually move into her house.
However, they still wanted to make it to England. That was the reason that they were in Calais in the first place, like thousands of others trying to cross the English Channel. And he and many others had made countless attempts to sneak onto trucks and sneak across the channel illegally and had been picked up by police every time. The exact same border police force that Beatrice had married one of. So she was widowed from a border police officer. This had really been her entire adult life, was sort of seeing her husband and his friends doing battle with these refugees. And suddenly she was on the other side of this very same conflict.
And Mokhtar and some of his friends then had a plan to get to the UK. Tell us about that.
They pulled together some of their money and they had Beatrice buy them a boat. And she then towed the boat out last June in the middle of the night at about 4 o'clock in the morning. And they set off across the channel from the town of Dunkirk over to England and made it. Finally, they arrived in the UK, where they are now being processed as refugees.
Beatrice paid for her action. She was actually arrested for people smuggling. Was she convicted?
In a decision that has just been announced today, Tuesday, she was convicted but not punished. In other words, they essentially split the difference legally. She could have been eligible for something like a 10-year prison sentence under this French law, but the court decided not to fine her or to send her to jail, but nonetheless to declare her guilty. She had clearly committed an illegal act, but the court decided that she had done it out of good cause. And as she said, she had acted out of love, and therefore she was prepared to break the law.
Correspondent Vivian Wald is based in Paris. She's been telling the story of Beatrice Ouray. Thanks, Vivian.
You're welcome.
I'm Carol Hills. There's rich, and then there's crazy rich.
In the house, they had a pond in the middle of the living room where there were baby sharks, and almost being enveloped by a tropical rainforest growing out of a pond in the middle of the living room. These are things you don't forget as a child.
Author Kevin Kwan on the lifestyles of Asia's rich and famous, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Here's a question scientists have been debating for years. Are bats special? I mean, aside from the fact that they're flying mammals that see with their ears, beyond that, though, researchers want to know whether bats have a special ability to carry viruses that can infect humans. Bats have been suspects in the emergence of diseases like Ebola, SARS, and MERS. Well, a new study published this week in Nature magazine may have settled the question. Disease ecologist Peter Deshack is a senior author of the study, and he helped track down the answer.
Unfortunately, they are special. They do have a higher proportion of viruses that are able to infect people than any other mammal group.
And why is that?
Well, no one knows the answer. It's quite interesting. There have been a lot of hypotheses put out there. You know, bats are very unusual in their habits when you compare them with other mammals. They live in often very dense colonies. Some species migrate huge distances, so maybe there are some adaptations to hibernation and migration that mean they have a different physiology. They also are quite diverse. There's a very wide group. So about a fifth of all mammals are bats. So maybe just by having so many different species, they've, over the millions of years, co-evolved with viruses to produce many more viral types. But again, nobody knows. Nobody really knows. It's an intriguing black box.
The other question is, if bats can harbor all these pathogens, how can they do that without themselves being harmed?
Yeah, and I think that drives a lot of the interest. Let's be honest, it would be wonderful, wouldn't it, to find one molecule or one immune response effector cell that bats have that we can somehow manipulate and suddenly cure ourselves of Ebola, SARS virus, MERS virus, and all the other things that bats carry. I don't think we're going to get to that level, but there may be something in bats, in their immune system, or in the way they've co-evolved with virus, that has a different sort of defense against viruses than humans do. So there are a lot of scientists out there who want to find that sort of holy grail.
Now, how did you figure this out? I mean, tell us about the research itself.
So we brought together every single virus known to us scientifically, every single mammal that those viruses infect, including humans. And then we created a database and started analyzing the database. It took us a long time to do, about 6 years to do the work. And what you can do is you can correct for the bias in reporting on some species versus others. Once you've done that, you can start testing and saying, do bats really carry more viruses than other groups? And it turns out that they do. But that doesn't mean to say we're going to get those viruses. Our research has shown that wildlife carry pathogens that eventually can infect us if we make contact with those pathogens. So I think this is really important. Bats are a critical part of the ecosystem. They get rid of pests of agriculture. They pollinate tropical trees. They're responsible to a large extent for some rainforest trees existing. So our message is, you know, if we don't go into habitats where bats live and destroy it, if we don't hunt bats, if we don't make contact with bats in a negative way, we won't pick up their viruses.
Has anyone ever been infected by a bat carrying a pathogen in North America?
Rabies. There have been rabies cases from bats in North America. And, you know, we still don't know the whole diversity of viruses that North American bats carry. So that work needs to be done too.
Now, I know you've been researching this question about whether bats are special for years, and in the past, you've argued that they're not. Were you surprised by what you found out through your own research?
Yeah, I was pretty sad, actually. I've got to be honest. I mean, bats get a bad rap. A lot of people say they're ugly. Actually, they're quite cute. You know, I've grown to really love them. A lot of people say they carry diseases. They're nasty. They get in your hair. Well, you know, I really didn't want bats to be special for viruses. So it was a surprise. And unfortunately, I was wrong. They are special. They do carry more viruses.
You were a bat doubter and now you're a bat believer.
That's right. I was a doubter and now I'm a bat believer.
Peter Deshack of the EcoHealth Alliance in New York City. He's one of the authors of the new study on bats and viruses published in Nature magazine. Knowing the potential importance of bats in transmitting diseases like Ebola is key to avoiding future outbreaks. Another key is vaccines against Ebola and other new viral diseases. And for Ebola, there has been a breakthrough. But as the world's Jasmine Garz reports from Uganda, the new vaccine won't slam the door on Ebola.
When it first started, Walter Odong thought his neighbors had been poisoned.
You could find in a family, three people are dying.
Walter lives in the northern Ugandan city of Gulu, a busy neighborhood where stray dogs and roosters stroll through a labyrinth of mud huts and cement block houses. It was rainy season, November 4th, 2000. Business was slow at Walter's soap shop, so he went home early.
Then I decided to go and watch television.
And when he got there, he found one of his young neighbors was really sick. So he took her to the hospital. And to his surprise, one of his friends was there. She was ill. He sat by her bedside.
She said, Walter, I'm very sick. I will not survive. I said, no, you will survive. You will walk home. She said, Walter, no. It's now too much for me.
A few days later, Walter's friend was dead, and so were three of the nurses who had cared for her. And Walter, he started to feel weird, disoriented.
The pain I was experiencing was the real pain. Severe headache, stomach, everywhere there were pain.
Weeks passed, and Walter was getting sicker. He says his fever spiked. He couldn't control his bodily functions anymore. By the time he checked into the hospital, it was understood that there was an Ebola outbreak in the city of Gulu. Ebola is transmitted through bodily fluids, even being splashed or sprayed by saliva or blood. Walter thinks he got it by leaning over his friend's bed, but it could have also been when he took his neighbor to the hospital. He'll never know.
The nurse was shouting from a distance, and I was left to sleep on the bed without mattress.
He was given a metal bed frame to lie on. At one point in his feverish sleep, he says he overheard his mother and his friends talking.
They were preparing for my burial. I could hear that, but I cannot respond.
They put Walter on a saline drip to keep him hydrated, but back then that's about as much as they could do to help those infected with Ebola. While Walter came close to death, his immune system was strong enough to fight the virus. Then, in December 2013, an outbreak in Guinea changed everything.
Now to the growing Ebola crisis. The virus does continue to march.
Dying of Ebola is a brutal process.
These patients are fighting one of the deadliest diseases in the world, Ebola.
That outbreak spread like wildfire across West Africa. It would eventually take more than 11,000 lives and years to get under control. It also created a real sense of urgency for a vaccine. Pharmaceutical giant Merck bought an Ebola vaccine being developed.
We now have a tool which has been demonstrated of being highly efficacious in protecting against Ebola infection.
Dr. Marie-Paul Kini is an assistant director general with the World Health Organization, WHO. Kini explains to me that this vaccine is preventative for the deadly Zaire strain, and the main goal is to vaccinate first responders, doctors, and nurses.
So that if there is a beginning of an outbreak, immediately you would have people protected in order to intervene.
And she says immunity in the body builds quickly, as fast as 10 days. So it might also be used for populations who could be exposed.
When there is a new case of Ebola, you go quickly to the field and you identify who are the contacts of this case, one who have touched the body, who have touched the bodily fluid, who have been living close to the person.
The vaccine licensed by Merck was tested during an outbreak last year in Guinea. It was a success, according to the WHO, but Kini says there is still work to be done.
In terms of improving the stability of the vaccine, because the one that we had used in Guinea needs to be stored at ultra cold temperature at minus 80, so that's not very easy.
When I visit Walter's neighborhood, the heat is sweltering and there are constant power outages. Also, this vaccine will only protect against the Zaire strain of Ebola. There are several other deadly strains out there. Experts say another outbreak is highly likely. Merck is pushing to have its vaccine available before that happens. But even then, this vaccine can't save you if you've already been infected. So Kini says there's a lot more work to be done, and she's looking forward to other pharmaceutical companies jumping into the market.
I was seated outside the ward under the mango tree.
One day, about a month after contracting Ebola, Walter woke up and felt well enough to go outside. He sat under a mango tree on the hospital grounds. By the time the epidemic had run through Gulu, over 400 people had been infected and more than half were dead. Walter's doctor died too. Walter was one of the lucky ones. But he realized as soon as he left the hospital that there was a stigma attached to having survived. When Walter got home, everything in his house had been burnt in an effort to stop the spread of Ebola in the neighborhood.
All my house, all property were burned, including even a plastic plate, by the way.
Nothing remained, except for Walter. For The World, I'm Jasmine Garzd, Gulu, Uganda.
That last big Ebola outbreak in Africa was big news here in the U.S. a few years ago. And as you might remember, some people from the region were able to take refuge from the disease here. Well, the Ebola crisis there is over now, so the U.S. government is asking some African immigrants to go home. But for many of them, that could be a problem. The World's Maria Muriel has been following the situation. Maria, who is being asked to leave?
Who's being asked to leave are people from Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, who in 2014 were granted something called temporary protected status. This is a status that the U.S. government allows to people from countries where there's a crisis going on. It basically lets them live and work in the U.S. for a temporary period. And in May, this status ran out for people from these three countries because the World Health Organization declared that the Ebola outbreak was over.
So they'd been given temporary protected status, or TPS, because of the Ebola crisis in their home countries.
Right.
And now that's come to a close. So are they getting deported?
No. They're being asked to leave. They have to get their own plane tickets back or their own travel back home, wherever that might be. And I spoke to Paul, who is a novelist from Liberia, and he declined to use his last name.
You cannot return because you don't even have the money to pay your air ticket. I'm married. I got a wife here.
So Paul is saying that he can't even take himself back to Liberia because he doesn't have the money, he's had trouble finding work, and he's married. He's already started making a life here since he moved here in 2014. And he's been doing manual labor wherever he can get it, you know, just temporary work, because employers look at his TPS and they say to him, you know, we can't hire you for a long time. You're not allowed to be here for a long time.
Now, if Paul has made a life here or is trying to, is there any avenue for him to stay on with legal immigration status?
Well, his wife is a legal permanent resident. They live in California. And Paul told me that she had petitioned for him to also get permanent status, but their petition was denied or they were asked to resubmit it. And generally, it's a really long process.
So TPS, it's not a way to immigrate here permanently. It's something that keeps getting extended and then may expire.
Right. And actually, the critics of TPS say that the program usually gets renewed too often.
And I know for Liberians, there's a large Liberian population here around Boston, and they've been getting extended TPS for years and years because of the Civil War.
Yeah, there's a lot of different reasons that countries have gotten a temporary protected status. It started in 1998, and usually the government renews it every 18 months. But, for example, Haitians recently were in the news because they were up for renewal and they only got a six-month extension, which is seen as sort of a phasing out of the program.
So if Paul does go back to Liberia, what are the conditions for him there?
Well, Ebola has been declared over, but I spoke to a Doctors Without Borders analyst who says that that's not the only thing to worry about health-wise. Recently, there was an outbreak of meningitis in Liberia, and there was an outbreak of measles in Guinea. And this analyst, her name is Mitt Phillips, she says that Ebola had long-lasting effects on the health services of these countries.
During the almost 2 years of the Ebola crisis, the health service could not function really optimally or correctly. Plus, the population was fearful also to go near to the health centers because the health centers were seen as places where you could get infected by Ebola.
So this is a long recovery. Just because the crisis is declared over doesn't mean that people are fine. There was a lack of vaccinations for other diseases as well.
Now back to Paul. Do you think he's going to go back or is he going to try to sort of stay under the radar here?
Well, last time I spoke to him, he wanted to stay. You know, also he said he wouldn't be able to find a job back in Liberia, that it would be really hard, harder than here, you know, where at least you can get contract work here and there. But that's not even possible for him anymore because since his TPS expired, he and all the other people in his situation are now living undocumented in the U.S. So basically your choice is to scrounge up the money and fly home or stay in the U.S. and be undocumented, and then you risk deportation.
Do you know what the estimate is for the number of people this TPS expiration date affects from Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea?
It's about 4,000 people.
Wow. The World's Maria Muriel. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Carol.
Let's talk about the 1% in Asia. Author Kevin Kwan was born in Singapore, but he lives in New York, and he's just released a novel called Rich People Problems. It's the last installment in a trilogy called Crazy Rich Asians. The books revolve around a few families that jet around in private planes and drop millions on fancy clothes. Kwan told me why he wanted to tell these stories.
There were so many economic reports and newspaper articles sort of painting a very unflattering light of the money coming out of Asia, you know, articles in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. And I really wanted to show the human side of this, the intimate side of this, you know, the sort of Downton Abbey in Asia plot lines of what it is like to be part of a family or a dynasty that's part of great wealth in Asia.
So give us a quick sketch of what the series is about.
You know, the series revolves around a large extended family called the Young Shang Clan, and it kicked off with book one when Nicholas Young, who is the sort of heir to the fortune, he's living in New York City, and he's a professor at NYU, and he invites his girlfriend, also a professor at NYU, her name is Rachel Chu, back to Singapore with him for a friend's wedding. And Rachel, you know, the heroine of the books, is an American-born Chinese who has really no experience of contemporary Asia. And when he takes her back home to the island of Singapore, she doesn't realize that she's stepping in all these different social landmines. And she doesn't realize, of course, that she's dating the most eligible man in Asia. So the knives are out for her. The future mother-in-law, all the other women in his life, and it creates for a nice, sort of nasty, fun drama.
Now, you've lived for many years in the U.S. I'm curious whether living here made you reflect back and think, gee, I've got some good writing material.
It really did. You know, I think when you're in the bubble or in the goldfish tank, you really can't see beyond it. But, you know, I moved to the United States when I was 11 years old. And since then, I think I've been sort of trying to make sense of the unusual upbringing that I had. So I remember clearly one day, you know, randomly I was taken to a friend's house and they had a vintage car collection ranging from vintage Rolls Royces to, I think there was a Lotus and a Lamborghini and several Ferraris. So they had this entire courtyard filled with these museum piece cars. And of course, you know, in the house, they had a pond in the middle of the living room where there were baby sharks. And that makes its way into my books, you know, sort of going into this beautiful grand living room and almost being enveloped by a tropical rainforest growing out of a pond in the middle of the living room. These are things you don't forget as a child.
One reason your books are so funny is that they seem to go really over the top. I mean, in your first book, an Asian family's turned away from a fancy London hotel room, so they buy the hotel. I mean, were you trying to paint a realistic portrait of the super wealthy in Asia, or were you also taking creative license?
I mean, at the end of the day, this is really high satire. You know, these are comedies of manners. It's meant to be funny. It's meant to be a very amusing and entertaining, hopefully. But so much of it comes from the truth. You know, that first story that kicks off the series, this family arriving in London in the mid-80s and being thrown out of the hotel because they are Asian, is a very real story. It's actually based on something that happened to a family that I know. So it's no coincidence that three of the top hotels in London are owned by Singaporeans.
Hmm. Now, speaking of private planes and buying up hotels, some of your characters seem almost like Asian versions of business people. I mean, dare I say Donald Trump. I mean, how do rich people in Asia compare to rich people in the U.S.?
Yeah, it did lead to some very interesting sort of soul searching. You know, one of the things that I do in my book is I really delineate the different class systems and the different types of money, because there has existed for centuries now an old money culture in Singapore that's very similar to, you know, sort of the WASP or the British aristocracy. But these great fortunes, these old fortunes, are clashing against so much of the new money that's been made over the past 30, 20 years in Singapore, in Southeast Asia. And then, of course, there's been the advent of the very, very new instant money coming from mainland China. So it's really about how all these different classes of money clash with one another.
You clearly enjoy making fun of wealthy Asian families, but there are also some very relatable characters, like the childhood friends Nick Young and Colin Koo. How did you strike a balance between satire and sympathy toward your characters?
You know, at the end of the day, I think these characters became very real to me. Their motivations, their fears, their desires, and their struggles. Even the rich have struggles.
In the U.S. these days, there's a lot of kind of chafing against the 1%. Does that chafing go on places like Singapore, too?
Very much so. Increasingly, people there are really noticing the wealth disparity. And so a lot of the elite have really gone underground with their spending. But I think there's always a crowd that will always try to flash their bling.
Kevin Kwan is a Singaporean writer and author of the very funny Crazy Rich Asians trilogy. Kevin, thanks a lot.
It's been a pleasure.
Let's go out today with what you could call a bit of bling of another kind. It's musical bling from Junka Nabe. He's a boo-boo musician from Sierra Leone, but he lives in the U.S. these days, and he's taken to dressing up his traditional music with modern elements.
Boo-boo music was played by bamboo sticks all the time. We use cane sticks to blow the music. It's a blowing music. So now I bring the music over the West, and I transform this cane stick to electrical instrument. Build music! And now we got organ, we got a bass, we got a guitar.
Bobo music, na salon bobo, build music, what a pattern, oh, bobo music.
A good example of this music is playing right now, build music. It's just about explaining to people how you like trying to build something new. and then trying to bring it out to the people out there, you see. So, I mean, that's why I titled the song Build Music.
Build music, Salon Baba build music, Salon Baba build music, what a patadi. Bobo music, Salon Baba build music, what a patadi.
I brought this music in America 2000 because there was a war in my country, run away from this war. I choose America to come here. And this is my 15 years in America playing this music. But right now it's time for me to go back. Because when you come place and then promote your music, you gotta go back. So this is time. We have a tour that we do in Europe, and after that I'm going back to Africa for me to go promote this music more. Thank you so much for listening. Bye.
I come for your Cabo Samaruti. I come for your Cabo Samaruti. I come for your Cabo Samaruti.
Music from Junka Nabe there, from Sierra Leone to the U.S. and now back again. You can hear more of it on his new album, Build Music, from the Nan Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Back with you tomorrow.
Build music. Salon Baba, build music. Build music.
PRI, Public Radio International.